Hello, everyone. Welcome to Energy Security Cubed, where we explore the pillars that form the nexus of energy security in Canada and the world: energy, economics, and the environment. I'm your host, CEO of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Kelly Ogle.
For today's podcast, we're featuring an interview with Gareth Gregory, head of Strategic Energy Client Delivery and 59hydrogen.com at Energy Security Services North America, or ESNA. But before we dive into that, I'll have a quick discussion with CGAI fellow and Energy Security Forum manager and my good friend Joe Callinan about the news features affecting global energy security this week. How are things with you, Joe?
I'm doing well, Kelly, and thanks for that. Well, you know, things are a little bit chilly out here in Calgary.
Yeah, it's cold out there.
I think people might have heard that I walk to work about 30 minutes every morning. This morning was a little bit windy on the way in, and my face almost froze off. But other than that, doing well.
It's good for gas prices. We've been saying that in Alberta here for a long time. Storage depletes really fast on days like today.
Oh, yeah.
That's good. What's going on out there, Joe, globally?
Well, there's a few things, Kelly. Let's start off with the trade clash between the United States and Europe. So trade tensions between the Americans and Europeans have been high since 2018, when the Trump administration imposed steep tariffs on European steel and aluminum and escalated a trade dispute between Boeing and Airbus. Upon coming into office, the Biden administration promised a more cooperative trade relationship with Europe, which included the establishment of the US-EU Trade and Technology Council in 2021 with the goal of promoting bilateral trade. However, this effort clashes with another key priority for the Biden administration, which is luring manufacturing to the United States. In his first week in office, Biden issued an executive order which strengthened the Buy American Act and followed this up with measures in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the CHIPS and Science Act, meant to direct government spending to local producers.
It's funny, over the course of time, since Obama, through Trump and through Biden, the U.S. has become much more protectionist in almost everything it does economically. And, this hasn't changed, obviously, as you've just laid out for us. And while these measures are not obviously combative as a pure tariff, they effectively give American manufacturers a huge leg up over European counterparts, especially given current costs of energy and other inputs, et cetera, in Europe. The Biden administration has also continued Trump-era policies around the World Trade Organization by continuing to block appointments to the WTO's appellate body, effectively restricting the function of the WTO dispute settlement system. And we see it here with forestry companies having to allocate cash to dispute settlement accounts, et cetera. Europe is most deeply concerned with U.S. subsidies for domestic production of electric vehicles, more specifically. With Europe currently facing an energy and economic crisis due to their reliance on Russian oil and natural gas, American policies could give auto manufacturers an easy choice to reshore to the United States. And due to the situation today, there are deepening tensions between Europe and the United States. Recently, French President Emmanuel Macron said that the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act risks fragmenting the West. Pretty strong terms, you know, standing in front of a podium in Washington, D.C. saying that. On Friday, European Internal Market Commissioner Thierry Breton pulled out of Monday's U.S.-EU Trade and Technology Council because there were not enough discussion around the Inflation Reduction Act on the agenda. For its part, the United States is unlikely to water down much of its commitment in the IRA. They don't have to. The question remains, how will the U.S. and EU negotiate their contradictory interests on these issues? I'm sure there's lots more to come here, but thanks for bringing to our attentions, Joe. What else is happening?
Yeah, we're going to transfer over to Latin America with an interesting bit of news in Venezuela. So after months of speculation, the Biden administration is easing some restrictions on Venezuela's oil industry. So on November 26th, Chevron, which is one of the largest non-state-owned oil companies in the world, was given an expanded license allowing the company to produce Venezuelan oil and ship this oil to U.S. refiners. So prior to the sanctions relaxation, most Venezuelan exports were sent to China through the global gray oil market of ship-to-ship transfers that China uses to import discounted oil from sanctioned entities like Venezuela, Iran, and now Russia. The relaxing of sanctions follows the resumption of talks between the Venezuelan government and the country's opposition. Continued sanctions relaxation will likely use the bargaining chip to bring about free and fair elections, which the U.S. likely hopes will cause a transition of power. Several domestic considerations probably factor into the U.S. decision as well. On the economic side, the United States remains vulnerable to high oil prices, which has led to a softening of the Biden administration's stance toward a variety of petrostates globally. And politically, Florida has moved from being a solid swing state to becoming a Republican state, which reduces the salience of taking a tough stance on socialist Latin American countries for the Democrats.
Yeah, it's like a non-starter, right? It doesn't matter. They're not going to get in. There's no political gain to be made in Florida like there used to be for these enhanced softening of relations with Latin American countries. Just yesterday, reports surfaced that Chevron would take control of the PetroPR upgrader, which converts heavy Orinoco Belt crude oil into light, low-sulfur Syncrude, not unlike how bitumen's converted into synthetic crude oil. The new supply of Syncrude from Venezuela is only permitted to be exported to U.S. refineries, where it will likely compete with the light shale oil produced domestically, and that caused an uproar from U.S. shale producer Continental Resources Chairman Harold Hamm, saying that the U.S., and I quote, does not need more of this foreign oil coming from a communist country like Venezuela. Harold Hamm's never been one to pull punches. It's unclear, however, how much oil and how quickly and at what grade will be exported from Venezuela to the United States. In October, Chevron CEO Mike Wythe said that it would take months and years in order to begin to maintain and refurbish fields and equipment and change any investment activity. Nonetheless, this could be an important turning point in the years to come. Venezuela, as many of you will know, has the largest oil reserves in the world, most of them heavy, like Canadian bitumen, but it is massive. And if foreign investment were to return, it could regain its traditional position as one of the world's largest oil exporters. I think we have to remember that there's more than just oil trade involved here. The geopolitical and existential discussions between nations and the national interest for Biden far outweigh some of the other reasons why this could happen. And I guess if the, you know, I was talking to the State Department last week in Ottawa, Joe, at the U.S. Embassy in Canada. And, you know, they really are trying to put some pressure on Venezuela to go back to have less of a captive socialist state and more democracy. And if that's the ultimate outcome, then more the better. So,
Absolutely. Good.
Thanks for digging that up, Joe.
Yeah, let's finish things off with a little bit of consideration of hydrogen and how it could impact North America's energy systems. So we'll be switching to an interview with Gareth Gregory in a moment about hydrogen. So this should provide some interesting context. On Monday, BP's head of hydrogen in the United States told Reuters that it is in early planning stages to develop a low-carbon hydrogen hub around its refinery in Whiting, Indiana. For context, the Whiting refinery is one of the largest refineries in the United States, with an atmospheric crude oil distillation capacity of 435,000 barrels per day. The Whiting refinery is crucial to Canadian crude oil demand as the single largest consumer of Canadian crude since it was upgraded to handle 80% heavy sour crude in 2013. It makes sense why Whiting would be chosen for BP's hydrogen hub. In refining, hydrogen is used to remove sulfur from sour crude oil in a process called hydrodesulfurization. The Whiting refinery currently uses around 200,000 tons of hydrogen a year for this process, which is around 2% of total U.S. production of 10 million tons of hydrogen per year.
Well, and people are going to learn in the next few minutes when we open up the conversation with Gareth, which is very interesting, by the way, and I think it flows right into this conversation, that that's 10% of the global hydrogen usage in the world annually. It's a big number. You know, it's important to remember that in the first stage of this project, BP plans to replace Whiting's current hydrogen consumption with blue hydrogen by capturing and storing the carbon produced by steam methane reformation, which is used with natural gas as the feedstock. The first stage is planned to begin operating in 26-27. Beyond this, the infrastructure will be used as a hub for other uses of hydrogen in the region and could eventually include green hydrogen produced from electrolysis. We'll see about that, but that's potentially there. There's a few takeaways here for Canadian crude oil. First, it means that one of the major buyers of Canadian crude anticipates that that will continue to be its feedstock and use a lot of hydrogen in the future, meaning that they'll need a lot more sour crude for decades to come. It also indicates BP's longer-term plan as a hydrogen company in addition to, as part of their energy mix, and setting up a hub in the Midwest in the long term makes a lot of sense. something to consider as the energy situation changes in Canada's most important oil market, thereof in the Midwest United States. Joe, thanks very much. There's some very interesting developments globally, and I appreciate you taking the time to go and dig these things out for people to get a better understanding of some of the things you may never know about.
Yeah, not a problem, Kelly. I do my best, so I hope this is all informative.
Great. Let's switch over to the conversation with Gareth Gregory. You're going to learn more about hydrogen in the next half hour than you've ever known before. For today's interview, recorded December 5, 2022, we discuss the economies of Canadian hydrogen, including production methods, use cases, and possible international partners. Really happy to have join me today from Calgary, Gareth Gregory. Gareth is the North American Head of Strategic Energy, Client Delivery, and 59hydrogen.com at Energy Security Services North America. Gareth previously served as the Africa Head, Strategic Energy and Client Delivery in the Commercial Division at Energy Security Services Africa. And before we start, Gareth, I had breakfast with Bill Whitelaw. He said to say hello to you. And I know Bill's a loyal listener to the CGI podcast. Thanks for coming on Energy Security Cubed.
Kelly, thanks a million for having us. It's a great privilege being here. And certainly it's going to be an entertaining hour.
Yeah, well, let's get after it. Why don't you give us a bit of background to our listeners of what Energy Securities North America is and what it does and what your sort of strategic plan is over the short, medium, and even long term?
Well, in short, Energy Security Services North America is a highly specialized energy modeling and planning company. We've built up extensive expertise in terms of decarbonization modeling. And if you think about the transition across North America now, that's exactly what the market needs and every sector and every government as well, in terms of understanding what that core fundamental is that's actually going to drive decarbonization moving forward. So that's one of the areas we are focused on. A few of the other areas, every one of our projects are centered on carbon-based value creation. And what that means is that there's a universal metric, which is a voluntary carbon credit or compliance, but in our case, certainly voluntary. And we need to be able to develop a universal metric, which is the carbon credit, in a quantum or a quantity that makes sense to the particular sector or the client that we're dealing with. So I'd say where a lot of the challenges are within the industry today is that there's insufficient focus on the outcome, and there's too much focus in terms of utilizing a substantial amount of unproved technology in the sector. So it's all about being able to monetize something or monetize a decision that's been made. And then last but certainly not least is really the ability to bring these solutions together as a complete package. And that's something that ESNA excels in, is our ability to really create end-to-end models that provide a benefit in terms of decarbonization on the one side, but on the other side, there's obviously significant benefit in terms of revenue generation.
My partner in the podcast, Joe Callanan, our energy security coordinator, and I, we've had several people on the podcast talking about hydrogen, you know, and I think, and I'm not trying to be trite, but a lot of the discussions are so far in the future as far as the uses and opportunities of hydrogen and cost structure thereof that, you know, I think in discussions I've had with you previously, the rubber meets the road here with what you're doing. Like, we're talking about a business model or the development of business models that are conducive to real-time usage here today, right? Is that not true? Like, we're talking about things that can happen right now, like not tomorrow, not next year, not 20 years from now when you're going to ship green hydrogen from somebody's spot with wind energy. This is using carbon today for a business that works today profitably.
That is dead on, Kelly. It's all about practicality today. And you're quite right. A lot of the discussion veers off where it actually needs to be in the international market as well as in the Canadian market and Western Canada as well, because we're so fixated in terms of what it could be as opposed to looking at the actual practical solutions that are available today, both in terms of generation as well as application. But I think the real important point here, and something that brings the practicality to this discussion, has to do with the modularity of what we do, right? So the entire world, even on the utilities field, is moving away from a centralized generation facility into decentralized generation. And it's quite ironic because hydrogen, if you look at the discussion in Western Canada today, it's all about centralized facilities, which is somewhat confusing, whereas we are practical on the ground delivering projects today through the modularity, the modular-based methodology of what we do 365 days a year. And that's what makes us relevant in today's setting, as opposed to a potential wish list for the near future, which is probably going to change in any event.
let's come back to that, but let's just sort of review with the folks that are listening where hydrogen fits into today and future energy systems. It's currently used primarily in refining and petrochemical sectors, almost full stop. Specifically, hydrogen is used to desulfurize sour crude oil and is a primary feedstock for manufacturing the two key components you've already mentioned. Well, one you mentioned, ammonia and methanol. There's about 90 million tons of hydrogen are used for these purposes globally out of a total consumption today of about 94 million tons. Do you see hydrogen mainly continuing to fill the, you've kind of partly answered this already, but does hydrogen continue to fill these roles in the future? Or are you stepping in, let's talk about your business case and what you see other avenues for hydrogen in energy ecosystems?
Great. So Kelly, it's always divided between the short, medium, and long term, right? And that's the practicality of business, is that you target the industries that are applicable in those particular timeframes and how the industry as a whole is obviously developing and moving forward. I think an important point here is that when we think about hydrogen, we've actually already thought about decarbonization first, and hydrogen just becomes the most applicable solution in that decarbonization model, if that makes sense. Right, so we're not trying to push a technology forward in the absence of a decarbonization model. We start with decarbonization and we understand which is the best possible fit into that environment. Now, it just so happens that hydrogen is a significant component of many decarbonization mixes that we develop. And midterm applications, sure, petrochemical is one of them. We're actually very busy with a highly innovative program as we speak now. But most importantly is the application of hydrogen over the past 10 to 20 years, 1 to 2 decades, where we've actually found the practicality and the implementation of that hydrogen molecule in different types of industries. And if you took a broad sweep as to where is hydrogen applicable today, both transitioning from the short term into the medium term, it's really very much focused in terms of a North American market as an initial step. And just some of the applications of hydrogen today could be focused in terms of stationary electricity generation for fuel cells. Fuel cells have taken a quantum leap in terms of applications. ESNA has a very innovative program where we've developed an electrolysis hydrogen generation system into a hydrogen store for solar PV systems, photovoltaic systems in the renewable energy sector, outperforming lithium iron phosphate by a factor of 31.4% on the levelized cost of electricity. So what does that actually mean is that for every kilowatt hour that is supplied into that particular application or that organization, our cost of electricity is 31.4% lower as opposed to a solar PV system coupled with lithium iron as a battery store. So that is pretty significant, and that is today. And those are systems we've already designed, built and commissioned, and we operate every single day of the year. The whole aspect around mobility is also critical. Now, we see the Hyundai Motor Corporation, they already have a hybrid battery hydrogen vehicle. So what is to come? Well, you need a decentralized supply of hydrogen. Is it about shipping it around the country in high-pressurized tube trailers, possibly, for the very, very short term? But that is also evolving and changing, which I think we can get into a bit more detail a bit later on. Then we've got a whole lot of other applications that take place. For example, in the food industry, it's most of the manufactured food assets and bases contain hydrogen today. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. The production of fertilizer, as you already mentioned, the manufacturing of paints and varnishes, there's an application in terms of hydrogen there. Welding, an industry or a trade sector that has been around for longer than both you and I. Extractions
you and
of
I combined.
Combined, correct. Extractions of metals, very, very relevant. Hydrogen peroxide, production of methanol. Glass production to a lesser degree in North America, but certainly something that's relevant in other parts of the world. So in short, Kelly, the applications are endless. I think you've got four primary sectors that are applicable today. And the balance of the sectors are really conducting some significant research and development as we speak in terms of those types of applications. So there's not a shortage of application here. There's a shortage of low-cost, low-carbon hydrogen kilograms to actually make that industry work without government subsidy.
So let's drill down on that a little bit, because, you know, according to the International Energy Agency, low emission hydrogen production today accounts for about 1%. Think about that, of total hydrogen production. So that's 1 megaton out of that 90, right? That's, yeah, 1 million tons, right? It's primarily from steam methane reformation of natural gas paired with CCS, carbon capture and storage, which produces hydrogen and captures the CO2 byproduct. That's obviously a limit. You're talking about things that go outside that envelope, right? Is that not like are the way different than steam reformation, which is the major process by which that hydrogen's developed?
Correct. So if you picture Alberta, for example, it's sitting on a phenomenal opportunity in terms of hydrogen generation for commercially based applications out of that sort of very narrow traditional idea that has been given, but as I've demonstrated, it's far broader than that.
Yes.
But what is important in terms of SMR and steam methane reforming is that if there's a practical step associated in that process to decarbonize, you can decarbonize. It just hasn't been implemented to date because there hasn't been a requirement to implement that level of decarbonization into the local industry. So it's not a matter that it's technically not possible. The fact of the matter is that it's actually very possible, but it needs the particular demand within the market to make that happen. So if you have a look at a relatively significant process such as SMR, steam methane reforming, there's a number of ways to actually decarbonize that entire process. At ESNA, in terms of our design, we decarbonize from a modular SMR basis up to 64% today. And we've got three major categories in terms of that decarbonization process through an SMR process. You've got syngas on the one side, you've got the tailing gas, and then you've got the flue gas. And for all your non-technical listeners, it's basically just different steps and phases of your production process as you're producing that kilogram of hydrogen. So the technology certainly exists today through PSA, pressure swing absorption, and membrane technologies through those phases to decarbonize up to 64%. And we're pretty confident that that level of decarbonization in SMR is going to be significantly higher over the next 5 to 7 years.
I think I want to go a little further than that. I want you to tell me, like, so I'm a gas producer in British Columbia or Alberta. Mm-hmm. And I've got excess gas that I'm either flaring it or I'm cutting back production because of gas that I can't manage. Come to me and tell me what you're going to do physically and mechanically to capture hydrogen out of that gas.
So to capture hydrogen out of the gas in terms of a conventional SMR facility, and just remember, there's also electrolysis that is applicable, which I'll explain shortly. In terms of the SMR facility, you've got a natural gas feed, a methane feed. And through that process, there's a number of chemical steps that are taking place that transitions that natural gas into a primary product, which is a hydrogen kilogram, plus byproduct out of that process. So if you've currently got a natural gas feed, number one, from an economic standpoint, you may be securing approximately a 27% margin on your wholesale gas price. With converting your process into an SMR process producing hydrogen, you would be able to add an additional 20% onto that wholesale margin within your gas operation that's obviously economically viable today. Not necessarily for your full production of gas, but certainly for a material percentage of it. So that's step number one, is understanding the economics. The natural step from there is getting a clear understanding as to what does that carbon liability look like through that process. And the reality today is that the consumer or the endpoint or downstream from the production facility is that everyone's getting a bit smarter, right? And they understand how they can benefit from a lower carbon scorecard in their industry, provided they're sourcing the right types of products from the right types of industries as well as suppliers. So their carbon content is absolutely key in terms of that of the decision-making process. And that's really the question you were asking me now from a technical standpoint. And as this process shifts from step one through to the last step, where you've actually got a hydrogen product, you've got three primary areas there that you're decarbonizing, or you have the possibility to decarbonize through as the process moves on. In many applications, the reason it's only 64% today is that the economic viability in terms of the first or the second process, which would be effectively the syngas or the tailing gas, right, The reason that that's so applicable is that that's the most economically attractive today in terms of decarbonization. But that 64% level is certainly bankable and is certainly applicable to the global hydrogen community as we stand here today. Last step in the process, which is the flue gas, and that's effectively your exhaust, is one of the most expensive areas, one of the most capital intensive areas to decarbonize through that process. But again, it's not about aiming for the absolute 100% in terms of a decarbonized process. It's about a methodical process. So if you generating gas today or you're producing gas, you have an opportunity of an alternative in terms of a hydrogen kilogram as a marketable product. And you have an option of either a hydrogen kilogram in terms of traditional sense or a hydrogen kilogram that is decarbonized, that is known as a low-cost, low-carbon, high-purity hydrogen kilogram. So for those organizations that are currently producing oil and gas, there's a phenomenal opportunity in terms of widening that product field into the market.
So in that process, or in any one of those three processes, what happens to the carbon? Like, is where does CCS fit into the schematic?
Yeah. So just like when we think about the technology, we think about the end-to-end decarbonization model. In terms of CCS, we think about CCUS, which is carbon capture, utilization, and storage. Right. So our business is purely focused on utilization, and the reason for that is that we feel that the future of a low carbon product has to do with the actual utilization of your carbon byproduct.
Right.
Correct.
So, like, are we talking about things like carbon black and products that we see in the world today that are in the energy sector in Alberta? It's become what's beyond bitumen. Are those would be, and I'm getting a bit off the, well, I don't know that I'm off the topic. I think this is the conversation that has to happen, is it not? Like, these are the things we need to think about as these technologies change and are added to.
Yeah, well, I think the answer here is actually a bit more practical and a bit more traditional than a carbon black. In terms of carbon black and those types of hydrogen generation processes that would have a byproduct such as carbon black, it's still an industry that is taking shape. It's still getting traction, and it's something that's going to take a period of time. The traditional utilization I'm talking about is through a gaseous CO2 out of the process, and that application is far more readily available today, both through industry on the one side, and then I know for ourselves, working through a very innovative agricultural process now in terms of utilizing some of that carbon application through various types of technologies, not to stray too far off the point here. But the bottom line is that capture is in a state or in a medium that can be utilized relatively easy across a number of traditional sectors today. The question associated with it has to do with saturation, right? So to what extent would these sectors be in a position to offtake and actually utilize this particular byproduct out of the SMR process? So the answer to that is that it's evolving, it's developing. And I know for ourselves, we have a number of practical relationships now within the market, and it's an area that's certainly developing. I'm not too sure about the storage side. I think it's something we've looked at numerous amounts of times. We also a bit more consistent in our thinking in terms of utilization as opposed to storage. And I think if we were to put our money on it, you'd probably see significant technical challenges on the storage side over the next 7 to 10 years, if not over a slightly longer period. So that's some mindset there, Kelly.
Yeah, I'm with you. I you know, the more I read about and more I hear about the storage part, and I hope, you know, as I say about all the parts of the energy ecosystem, everything's in play. Like, we need all of the tools in the toolbox, and that's one of them. It seems to me, though, that this is more, you're getting, you know, we're breaking down the molecules here, and you're finding ways to be more effective and affective to the whole stream by talking about products as opposed to just storing, like getting rid of it. Before we leave this, because I've got a lot, there's a whole bunch more things I want to talk to you about. And we're going to move existentially here in a minute. But what you're talking about, these processes, how do they compare to the what's out there today? With, you know, I'm thinking that the cost of a green hydrogen kilogram is about $7 or $5 to $7 or something like that. What are we talking about economically here, Gareth, as far as what you're talking? Because it's, you know, we call it Energy Security Cube for a reason. Economics has to be part of the discussion. And where are we with your processes as far as economics on a per unit basis?
It's a great question, Kelly. And you've got to remember, when we consider economics, it's direct and indirect, right? So on the one side, you may be able to produce something relatively cheaply, but on the other side, you've got a carbon liability. And it's all about balancing those two areas out to find a middle ground for the foreseeable future and something that's going to evolve and change over a period. Now, before I get into the answer there in terms of the colors of hydrogen, which makes us extremely nervous because we work on percentages, right? From cradle to grave, to the level to which we have decarbonized, that's an X percentage, right? We stay away from the different colors of hydrogen, and the reason being they've been so politicized that they're actually being stretched out of proportion now in terms of their true scientific meanings.
Yeah, so, I'm sure. So I'll just interrupt you for a second. I told you, you're absolutely correct. Like, the color thing is all political. I'm sure that the scientists, they just roll their eyes every time they see something about another color, right? Like, go into that a little deeper percentage wise, and I think you're getting right to the crux of the matter that I want to discuss.
Yep. So when we, and let's do this practically, Kelly, because, you know, we can talk around in circles here for the whole day, but let's take client X as a prime example, right? This particular client has a flow of natural gas available, right? And they have aspirations because they've already developed a very detailed decarbonization model that informs the investment horizon. They understand that hydrogen provides both an on-site operational, producing oil and gas company, and an on-site operational benefit because they've got a decarbonized fuel stream that's either blended or direct for production purposes on-site. And in addition to that, they've got an economic opportunity to actually broaden their traditional oil and gas sector into other areas such as the hydrogen economy. Now they sit with various options and they have a look at hydrogen technologies, and because electrolysis has been so politicized, and in fact, hydrogen end to end, a lot of the figures have been pulled out of proportion. And there's a very similar discussion in terms of solar PV as well as the wind industry. You know, a wind turbine will never recover its own carbon footprint in its entire life, right? But because it's been classified on a piece of paper that it's renewable, it's taken at face value that it's actually a benefit to our global warming position, which it definitely isn't. So then you bring that same discussion back into hydrogen generation, and you have a look at the one side where we've got steam methane reforming, SMR, and on the other side of the fence, we've got green electrolysis. Now, we must be a little bit careful when we refer to green electrolysis, because it all depends on whether the electricity feed is coming into the electrolysis system to produce the hydrogen. So even though you may be thinking you're producing a relatively clean product because you're splitting H2O water into hydrogen and oxygen, the reality is that the upstream of you, in terms of that electricity supply, it's either coming from peak load diesel, it's coming from coal, or it's coming from other sources which are fundamentally not clean to the level that they could be clean in terms of technology that could be applied. So when a company goes out to market and says that they're producing a green hydrogen, I kind of shudder a bit, because I think there's a 99% chance that hydrogen kilogram is nowhere close to green, right? It's actually just a labeled product, which is completely misrepresentative. So getting back to the oil and gas example, you've got two technologies. On the one side, you've got steam methane reforming, SMR, and on the other side, you've got electrolysis. We know for a fact, if ESNA produces its own electricity on site, for that powering of that electrolysis system, we've got a significantly higher value product because it's got a lower carbon rate within that hydrogen kilogram. So when you have a look at the economics, on the one side, you've got to look at water usage, because both processes utilize water. In addition to that, you've got to look at the amount of electricity required out of the program. So your SMR process would be materially lower than your electrolysis program. But when you look at the quantities that are being produced through the process, your electrolysis produces far higher kilograms or far greater volume in terms of your end product as opposed to your SMR process. You can control your carbon levels so much easier. And of course, you know, when we look at simple stuff such as footprint, that's also applicable here. So we've got to narrow this down, and we've got to bring this down to a point where we've got a universal metric again. And the universal metrics are one of two things. On the one side, it's your levelized cost of hydrogen. So how much does it actually cost you to produce 1 kilogram of hydrogen, just understanding that we're optimizing the decarbonization through both processes as far as possible. And the second metric that we've got to look at is what rate will we be able to achieve in terms of that voluntary credit on the open market, because we've taken that additional step to actually reduce the carbon exposure or the carbon liability in the kilogram of product that we're producing. So it's never as simple as just considering some high-level facts on two competing technologies. And I'm standing here today and I'm confirming with you, for our oil and gas clients, we can produce hydrogen through an SMR steam methane process, modular in nature, that's bankable, applicable to the market, and we can decarbonize up to 64%. Or we can put an alternative on the table, which we model every single day, 365 days a year, where we look at a very clean on-site electricity generation source into our system, into the electrolysis system. And of course, then we guaranteed and we know for a fact that we're producing a very low-cost, low-carbon, high-purity carbon kilogram. And of course, without mentioning it, purity is absolutely key, because below a certain threshold, there's fuel cells that will automatically switch themselves off. And again, it's losses for courses, right? So it's understanding what you're producing. So just in summary to your point there, Kelly, it's never possible to apply a blanket approach to each and every scenario. Number one, it needs to be modeled. And secondly, I believe that electrolysis is coming of age now. It's becoming highly competitive with the on-site electricity generation program to obviously meet those requirements of that low-cost, low-carbon, high-purity hydrogen kilogram.
I hope people will think about what you've just said, because it really does, that's where the rubber meets the road. Obviously, there's no question that, the business owner, that oil and gas producer, they've got to drive their business to where it's profitable, right? And you're not just doing things for the sake of doing it. And I think you've given us a very good indication that is possible and is in process. Gareth, you talked a lot about universal marker for carbon, and I want to move over to international discussion of hydrogen and exports. Michael Liebrecht, the co-founder of Bloomberg, is notoriously a skeptic of international hydrogen transport. In a recent Twitter thread, Liebrecht blasted the idea of international hydrogen transport by pointing out that liquefied hydrogen carriers would only carry a quarter of the energy of modern LNG carriers. Remembering hydrogen is the lightest molecule, number one in the periodic table, so with much higher liquefaction cost losses because it boils off. He also doesn't have much good to say about ammonia, the current preferred shipping method, by pointing out that the additional losses caused by the Haber-Bosch process, whatever the hell that is, to convert hydrogen into ammonia would make it just as economic as liquefied hydrogen. Tell us what the Haber-Bosch process is, and do you have a rosier view of transporting hydrogen than Liebrecht does?
Yeah, so...
Are we going down a rabbit hole you'd rather not go down? I think you've got of all the people we've had on the conversations, Gareth, you've got a better understanding of hydrogen from a practical perspective than a lot of folks. And I think your comments would be well appreciated.
Yeah, no, that's great, Kelly. I sometimes wonder if discussions are better over a beer or not. But everything that you stated there, I think we're very much aligned with it. The option of hydrogen, maybe just to take half a step back and provide a bit of context, has been terribly confused with decarbonization, right? And instead of looking at the decarbonization objective of stimulating economies and meeting global warming initiatives and thresholds, right, the political environment sort of skewed the decarbonization discussion into hydrogen, which I think was a fundamental mistake. And for that reason, that's why we sit with a multitude of hydrogen hubs around the world, but I never see any decarbonization hubs, right? Which is really, really concerning, because hydrogen is not a golden bullet, right? That's one bullet, but there's another 90 around them that need to be modeled and obviously applied to industry. The comment that's been made in terms of international shipping, bulk transportation to other countries is really dead on here. If we were to estimate it, say that bulk export is at least a decade to 12 years out, if not a little bit longer. And the reason being is that your technological advances are so significant and so aggressive now that I think, you know, ammonia is probably not even going to be a discussion a decade from now in terms of bulk transportation. And it comes with a lot of challenges, as you correctly mentioned, in terms of the brief summary. So if you understand the Haber-Bosch process, you know, it's sort of over a century old now. And, you know, it converts atmospheric nitrogen into ammonia, which is the chemical equation, there's NH3, by combining it with hydrogen. So hydrogen with a combination is a significant part of that process. And the process combines a single nitrogen molecule with three hydrogen molecules to produce two molecules of ammonia. So that's the technical side of it. But in saying that, all the things that you mentioned there in the introduction to this question are dead on. So you have far lower volumes being exported. And what does that mean? Well, in actual fact, you probably started off with a relatively dirty process. So you're not looking at the complete cradle to grave carbon position of that.
Right,
of
back to the start again, right? Like it's
exactly.
It's like that comment you made about the wind turbines. If you think that you've got that, you can apply a levelized cost of energy against your hydrogen production. But if I agree with you that you'll never get full rate of return on the implementation of the wind tower, then turbine. You know, we got to talk about the whole process here. Like, it's not exactly fair to other parts of the energy sector. So sorry to interrupt, but I think it's important to remember that it's the whole picture here.
Sorry exactly to interrupt you. And no, not at all. And you want to simplify your process as far as what you can, right? So you know, just remember, once that ammonia shipped and you require a hydrogen product at the other end, there's obviously a reverse reaction that needs to take place to obviously be left with a marketable product. So you add all the intermediary steps into account, all the intermodal transportation, and you're actually in quite a severe position in terms of global decarbonization. So I agree with you completely, but it is definitely back to step one. But as that is taking place, and there's various technologies developing around that and a lot of thought, you know, we've got to think about the economics of it as well, in terms of the levelized cost of hydrogen. And what does that actually cost in terms of all the losses during transportation, etc.? And where do you end up in terms of that hydrogen kilogram from a cost standpoint? And some of the figures that you mentioned earlier today are probably representative of that, if not a bit higher, where we know for a fact through our modular processes, we're producing anywhere from a retail standpoint between $1.93 to $2.85, right? That is today. So it's not even going to be competitive in terms of decentralized hydrogen generation if we go down this route today, and the significant investment that takes place in this particular transportation medium. So just to reiterate, I think we know less than about 10 to 12 years out. I think I sincerely believe that ammonia is an interesting application in various sectors. Is it a transportation medium? I do not, for the reasons that I've obviously already mentioned. The market's catching up in terms of metal hydride solutions, which is also very, very important. And just remember, you know, ammonia is the main hydride to nitrogen, which is a non-metal. So we've got evolution now, evolutionary technology and R&D that's taking place in terms of a metal hydride solution for transportation. So that whole mindset is obviously shifting as well. Then you add another level of complexity on top of it, which is modularity. And remember, something that's done politically around the world is that everyone tries to find one golden solution that can be applicable and can be the best possible solution for all sectors. Right? It just doesn't exist, right? Our clients that would utilize an electrolysis-based hydrogen generation solution have very specific geographic elements around them that makes it possible. In terms of other clients, in terms of SMR, Alberta, perfectly positioned. Is it for the export market? Probably not. Is it for the local market in terms of North America? I mean, there's such demand that's starting to get its initial days of traction now, and it's going to be a completely different field sort of 5 to 10 years from now. So, you know, you add all this together, you can get an economic perspective out of it, you can get a technical perspective out of it, and you can start getting to a point where there's actually reality in terms of what should be done. And, you know, we've got to be genuine in terms of what we do, and we've got to get out of this notion that just because something's put through a policy or regulation that says this type of generation is green, in reality, it actually isn't. Right. So we've got to look at the whole value chain, because who are we fooling, right? We are effectively fooling ourselves right. in terms of a cleaner future for both our children, our grandchildren. And as philosophical that might sound, that's the bottom line reality, Kelly, is that there's too much focus on the wrong areas and not enough focus in terms of practicality as to what should be focused on and what should be done now. So I don't believe that ammonia is going to be a significant transportation medium anywhere in the next 15 to 20 years for those reasons.
Okay, so I just want to finish up here. And there's, you know, this has been a very interesting conversation. And Gareth, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. I think this has been, it's kind of groundbreaking for us because it's so crucial to the whole decarbonization idea. But, you know, Canada a week ago today released its Indo-Pacific strategy, and Japan and South Korea are identified as potential partners in the hydrogen export process from Canada's West Coast. Now, you've kind of poured hot water or cold water on any, in my mind, and ideas about transporting hydrogen with ammonia. But what about the transport of ammonia itself? Because ammonia can be dripped into coal-fired electrical generation, right? Like you start replacing, and I think that's the what Japan's after is to try to get off coal for power generation. Does ammonia not fit part of that schematic? And what about transporting ammonia rather than using it as a transport fuel? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, and I guess, again, it goes back to fundamentals. And there's a lot of things that are possible. There's a lot of things that are applicable to today's environment, right? But when you model it, is what you want to look at, if you've got multiple scenarios that you're working through, which scenario gives you the highest probability of economic return on the one side, but on the other side meets all your decarbonization objectives at the same time? So it's a good question that you ask. I think it's a question and it's a solution that needs to be modeled to the nth degree. And once you model that, you need to have a basis and you need to make a decision on the basis of probabilities as to which combination of which elements are going to give you the greatest outcome and the greatest benefit and reduce your liability the most. So the short answer is yes. A lot of these things are applicable, they are possible today. Does it really provide us with the solution and the end game that we're driving towards here? And that is the serious question here. So I'd be reluctant to give a definitive answer in terms of, yes, I mean, this is an avenue that we should be heading down. I'd rather say to you, this actually needs to be modeled and we need to understand that whole value chain to start before we can make those types of decisions.
You know, that's I think a good place to stop, because I'll just put a plug in for your organization. You know, modeling is a necessary part of strategic development of products and the rollout of longer and middle and longer term strategies. And I thank you very much for coming on, Gareth. I think the beauty of this podcast for me is we've left a whole bunch of questions unanswered. At the same time, I think we've given a fundamental building blocks of how hydrogen works in the future ecosystem of the total energy process. And thanks for coming on the podcast. We always ask our guests before they go, I know you've got young family and you're climbing mountains and going skiing and learning how to play hockey since you moved from SA, but what are you reading these days?
Yep. So one of the books that I'm reading now is on Lafayette, which is the hero of two countries or two nations, right? That's yep. The political read that I'm on at the moment. And then sort of a variety of other books. But I think through the month, I tend to read quite a bit of different material. But I think Lafayette in himself was pretty remarkable in the way that he repositioned and restructured himself. politically, which is a great step in the right direction, always extremely practical, was a significant component of abolishing slavery across North America. And, you know, if you just look at that methodical process that he went through in terms of holding back where he needed to hold back in terms of some pretty intensive political situations, and then the ability to actually act practically on the ground, obviously set himself aside. So that's one of the current reads, with probably about another five next to my bed and in my bag.
That's great, Gareth. Thanks so much for coming on. It was fun.
Likewise. Thank you very much, Kelly. Have a great day.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Energy Security Cubed on the Canadian Global Affairs Podcast Network. You can find the CGAI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give it a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. If you like this episode and want to help us keep creating content, you can support us by donating at cgai.ca/support. Energy Security Cubed is brought to you by our team at CGAI. Thanks go out to our producer, Joe Kalman, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Kelly Ogle. Thanks for joining us on Energy Security Cubed.